It's time now to get inside the world of medicine as prominent physician Dr. Joseph J. Fallon Jr. and well-known philanthropist Cal Rudman team up to bring you Inside Medicine. Stay tuned for interviews with eminent medical specialists and receive vital information about your health. This could be the most important radio show you'll ever listen to. Now, here are Dr. Joseph J. Fallon Jr. and Cal Rudman on 610 ESPN.
Good morning, everybody. It's Inside Medicine at 10 a.m. on Saturday, going to 11. We have a dynamite program today, and we're going to have a super dynamite program next week. We're going to have a physician who practices in Thailand, who's specialist in menopause, libido issues, and also has practice where Ebola is. A very well-rounded physician. He'll be calling in, Dr. Eric Fleischman. So next week, you're going to see different drugs and overall pharmacology that he uses to solve people's problems. But tonight, or today, we have one of the most dynamic internists in the Philadelphia marketplace. That's Dr. Lisa Domitio. She works for Jefferson Primary Care, and she is going to talk basically about millennials and anxiety. And we do know that one of the ways of living a long time is to make sure that you don't have a lot of anxiety. And Dr. Domitio is going to help us out to the T. And you'll love her personality. And Cal wanted to open up the show with the first question.
First question, define anxiety in the millennial and why the focus on this area is a big portion of her practice.
Well, good morning, and thank you, Cal and Dr. Fallon, for allowing me to be on the show this morning. And my friends, anxiety is all around us. There are literally 264 million people who do have anxiety. So if you have it, you're not alone. But what exactly is anxiety? It's essentially a feeling of doom about activities or events that occur more days than not for about 6 months, and it's simply paralyzing. It causes distress. It causes functional impairment. And it really causes people to worry more than expected about minor issues that the anxiety is just really too difficult to control. So even though it's really something in the psychiatric world, it really does call very real medical symptoms, palpitations with heart racing, like I said, the feeling of doom, lightheadedness, dizziness. So it's really up to us as physicians to separate what exactly is anxiety and what really is something medical. Is it someone's heart actually racing, or is it someone's thyroid out of control causing the symptoms, or is it all anxiety? It could be a multitude of factors. So if doctors, that's our job. We have to separate the symptoms, rule out what the anxiety is, what is medical, and go from there. In the psychiatric world, there is something called DSM-5, which basically is a diagnostic, statistical manual of medical disorders. So this is the psychiatrist's tool, and this is published by the American Psychiatric Association. And basically, this helps us with treatment and recommendations that are determined and basically recognizing three criteria of the following. Are you experiencing a lot of restlessness? Are you tired? Are you irritable? Do you have muscle tension, sleep disturbances, difficulty concentrating, and a multitude, of the other symptoms that I mentioned?
So, Dr. Domitio, so when you see a patient, how many of those things tip you off that you've got to address that?
Well, you know, Joe, it's a great, great question because a lot of them, it's a couple of them, the restlessness, the fatigue, the irritability, and the whole story behind what causes those things. If they have certain episodes or they have certain things in their lives going on that are really causing these symptoms, then that is definitely the anxiety. But then we kind of rule out the thyroid, rule out other things as well also to make sure we're not missing anything.
So you're saying as an internist, you want to be comprehensive and not miss something that's physical.
Exactly.
But that overall, you know, mental status does play a big role in how long someone lives and how well they live.
Absolutely.
So how did you get so acutely good at this?
Well, basically, you know, I deal with patients in internal medicine between the ages of 18 and 100. And I'm really not a psychiatrist, But when millennials come in for physical exams, college medical forms to be filled out, it's with a discussion that the anxiety issue becomes very, very apparent. Now, even sometimes parents entrust their children's treatment to me, which I'm very, very honored to care for them. They see signs of anxiety. So before they come into the room, they push me aside and say, listen, please address this. Or, Molly or Jamie has been very withdrawn from activities, not acting correctly to simple situations, failing out of school when she was an A-plus student. She's overreacting to simple situation. Or their friends have been telling us how the kids are just not acting appropriately. And, crying, shaking over very, very simple situations. So it's the recognition of the symptom of the anxiety by parents, by friends, by teachers, or any loved ones that really is the first step to helping these millennials with the problems.
So Dr. DiMedio, what is the definition of a millennial?
So, the millennials are much younger than I am right now. They're born between the ages of 81 and 96, which would make them between the ages of 22 and 37. So they're the key time in their life. It's a very, very time in their life where they really decide. It's a lot of decisions are made. A lot has come to them. They're in the big people's world now, and a lot is going on, which can cause a lot of the anxiety as well.
And so what is the definition of anxiety? You gave us that big book that doctors use, DMSO. What was it? I thought that.
The DSM-5, yes.
DSM-5.
Now we finally know what that exactly. Never knew it was until I looked it up. But yes, doesn't say much for me. But yes, I mean, that's their world. But that is actually what we use as tools indirectly, we even knew, to decide how to treat them and where we would, point, what direction we would point them in.
Got it. So how millennials get anxiety? How many of these people are getting hit with this?
Well, it's about not so much. There's 264 million people have the anxiety. And I'm going to say about one out of every five person that walks in my office does have it as a millennial. And what we do is that we screen them. So they may not come in anxious, but by the end of the visit, hopefully I don't make them anxious, I can screen them and say, do you experience excessive worry? Is your worry so excessive in intensity? Is it causing you not to enjoy your life? Does it cause you distress that you're not sleeping? Do you find that it's so hard to control once it starts? Do you really, really worry excessively or uncontrollably about these small, small issues? And if you really get yes to a couple of them, because that's our screening tool that we use, then we basically then point them in a direction which we'll discuss with medications and therapists and psychiatrists to really receive this diagnosis of anxiety.
So when someone shows up, they're coming up for a sore throat, and you're able to more or less probe and find out that, hey, there's something else that really they're there because of a sore throat, supposedly, but they're really there because they've got underlying anxiety, and you have to be able to discern that?
Yes, exactly. I mean, and I always tell them, we always think medical first, what can kill first. Not obviously a sore throat's going to kill them, but what's the most important, and then we go to the anxiety because that's just as important, but we want to make sure that that's not causing their physical problems.
Well, that is impressive. So the sources you use to help out, it seems like you if the parents are around or some friends call you, do they give you that access? Do you get that access in your group?
Yes. I mean, as I said, there are a lot of there's a lot of literature out there for patients, families, and friends. I mean, they have anxiety and phobia workbooks. They have books called My Age. There's a multitude of books. It's amazing. My Age of Anxiety, How to Stop Worrying. I'd like to read that book myself. Understanding Millennials, Tips and Tricks for Working with This Generation. Broke Millennials, Not Everyone Gets a Trophy. Millennials Matter, 5 Tips to Managing Millennial Employees. I mean, this is great. It's great. It's not attacking any group. And that is one thing I want to make sure that it is an entity. It is something out there. But if the parents read it, physicians, we should read it. It gives us a view of really how prevalent this is and how to really make them not as anxious and to bring it up at a visit and try to help them out as well also.
So Lisa, the issue here is that there's one book that you would give because you've got a whole, you're focusing on the millennials because you obviously are good at that age group. But how about the senior citizens? Do they have that too?
Yes, absolutely. I mean, as I said, that's I mean, when you deal with the greatest era that's ever been around, it's when you talk about the people that are in their 70s, their 80s, you know, their definition of anxiety is different. And the problem is this. Back in their day, they never really spoke about it. It was, you just pushed it on. You just moved on. That was it. I mean, they lived in an era where they didn't have a lot of money. They lived where five kids had one bathroom. I mean, it was just different today. It would be a little different of a reaction. But they really just got it, and it's a different thing. So then you talk about anxiety then, which they really didn't have, and then you move up to the 70, 80-year-olds where they're anxious, and which becomes depressed because they're afraid. How much longer am I going to live? How much money will I have? Will I have enough money? Will my kids rob me blind and I won't have anything? Will they come see me when I go to the nursing home? Will I fall and get hurt? And the biggest issue, the anxiety, is will I be a burden, which is definitely an attribute to that era because they always were worried. I mean, their children were everything, and they really worry about that a lot.
So how do you handle that one? That's a tough one.
It is. And, you know, I sit with them, we hold the hand, and we say, listen, if they didn't love you, they wouldn't have brought you in. That's number one. So that you're in the right direction.
Are you sure about that?
Yeah, that's
true. Something called sex.
Yeah, they're bringing the office, as I said. And then the other thing is this. It's just that, you know what, then they're also very, a lot of them, you know, believe in God. They're very religious. They pray a lot. And they really feel as though they're very thankful for what their family members do. When they're not, I say to them, listen, we can't fix everything. Your spouse, I mean, your children are very busy. They're busy with their children, and they understand that. They just love being surrounded by their grandchildren. And sometimes they need medications just to get them so they're not so sad, because we don't want them so sad that they don't want to come out and they don't want to socialize and they don't want to be around family members. You want them to do that because that's what keeps them going until their last breath. So a lot of them don't like the idea of medicine. They want other ways of talking to it. And a lot of it, the anxiety and the depression, is about loneliness, as I said. So I think that if we can get them to that area where at least they can be with others and mingle with others and be with the ones that love them the most and the ones that they really feel the most comfortable with, I think that's the best thing in the world.
So you're saying that human communication is very important.
The most. Like, don't be texting grandma because she ain't going to text you back. I mean, it's not, that's not what makes them happen. In fact, that whole era, that whole thing of texting and phones get them very angry because they feel as though they're taking time away from them. And they're, although all that information is on the internet and is on their phone, it really is taking away from learning from the greatest generation ever.
Well, I have to say this, that my kids are just laugh at me because I read the Wall Street Journal and they get it online. It doesn't bother me too much, believe me, but God help me. But I do have to tell you one funny story what you're talking about. We had a patient who was the last survivor of a couple, and the lady basically fixed up her house at the shore and put all new windows in, spent all sorts of money, and then told the kids at Christmas time that, guess what, I'm turning this over to you. And the problem was they were not appreciative at all. They just basically didn't say thank you and all that kind of stuff. I guess they thought they were entitled. So the lady calls me up and says, guess what? I'm going to make myself a no code. So she comes into the hospital about a month later, and she's a no code, and she has a heart attack, and she's in the ICU, and I'm standing there, and I say to the nurse, look, the pulse is dropping. The nurse said, look, doctor, she's a no code. We can't do anything for her. And literally to this day, I am sure she wanted to die because her kids just weren't appreciative of what she gave them.
Yeah, absolutely.
So it's a tough deal. But that was, I see the pulse, pop, 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 and you just see her melt away. And I know that's what she wanted to do, but I just felt as a physician, you would have liked to help her out. But the real deal was she wanted to go to heaven.
Yeah, and a lot of them feel like that, especially when they lose their spouse with their children. I'm not saying all of them, because a lot of families do keep their people, their family members going. But it's hard because they feel as though, hey, their buddy or their spouse of 60 plus years, they really understood it. They got it. And then they feel as though nobody's going to have that time and nobody's going to really understand that whole relationship.
Dr. DiMedio, you're on top of it. That's all I can say. Is there anybody who you have to refer patients to in your practice as an internist who's very discerning?
You know, it's interesting because we start the ball rolling. I mean, as I said, and that is our job. You know, as I said, and it's, again, it's my job to say to them, you're not alone. It's not embarrassing. I said, there are a lot of people. There are a lot of people in your group, as I said, and we just don't want to make everybody crazy about the way you feel. So how are we going to do this? How do you want to do this? So we talked to them. There's a lot of things out there. There are medications, as I said, and that's basically the treatments, like the list of medications called SSRIs, which are Prozac, Zoloft, Lexapro, Celexa, very known to the outside. This is the first line because it doesn't really cause a lot of side effects in young people. You know, as I said, Buspar. Again, you start these medications at very, very low doses, and then you increase them. Now, we don't want these young people on them because we don't, even if they go out and they have a beer or they have a drink, which, you know, I want them to enjoy themselves, but we don't want another dependency starting either if they're so anxious or if they're so sad about the way things are. There also are benzodiazepines, which is like a Valium, things like that, but we want to be careful because of the fact that we don't want another, again, another dependency starting. So maybe a short period of time, and that's for people that it's so paralyzing. And I have a few patients like that where they don't want to leave a room, where they're making the parents nuts because they don't want to engage like young people should engage. But we just want them to get out there, at least want to talk to somebody. These are the people that don't even want to talk to anybody. Nobody will help me. I'm, you know, nobody can help my problem. This is what we really want to go to the next level for.
So let me just clarify this. So you want short-term deals, but now what about your SSRIs? Are they a short-term deal? What's the definition of short-term?
Now, short-term meaning this, is that if we utilize the SSRI for 6 months, plus getting them through this, plus possibly talking to a psychologist, which God bless all of them in mental health because they do amazing work, maybe with a combination of that plus cognitive behavioral therapy, putting basically that the psychologist explain to really basically have a game plan of how to deal with it. How do I cope with it? That's our thing. Instructions to how to alter this whole person's behavior in a positive manner. So if you use the SSRIs, use the cognitive behavioral therapy, you can do it by itself. You could read books on this. There are a multitude of books out there for that. Or you could use it with the mental health professional. And maybe, just maybe, by maybe writing it in a journal, it'll trigger, hey, what's making this millennial so anxious? They don't want to go to work. They're anxious. They don't want to socialize with their friends. I mean, this is your best time of your lives. So to do that, plus seeing a therapist, plus these medications, if they have to be on them longer, that's fine. But believe it or not, Joe, they do say, I want to get off the medications. I don't want to be on medicines my whole life, and I'm ready. And that's the best words that I could hear, because I think that they've figured out the problem.
So I got to give you a case study here. So I had a patient who has a tourist business, and they have to be, when tourist time is, they have to be able to work 14-hour days. Mm-hmm. And the wife calls me up and says, Doctor, you have to help me out here. My husband is only working 4-hour days, and we need 14. If we don't, you know, if he doesn't help us out here, we're going to go out of business. So gave him Prozac, told him in 14 days, call me back if it's no better. I get a call back 12 days from the wife. Dr. Fallon, he's working. And then she hangs up. I don't know what kind of personality she had. But 2 days later, I get a call back from the dentist, and I'm going to stop the medication. I'm on this Prozac for 14 days, and at 12 days, I felt good. I'm back up to working 14 hours, and I'm going to stop the drug. I'm just curious, what do you say to that?
Well, I mean, it's like somebody who gets their cholesterol check, and their cholesterol's great on cholesterol medicine. Can I stop it? Not really, as I said, because it's the medicine that's helping it. So the suggestion is, listen, you stay on it for a good, 3 months. Let it really, I mean, if you're working 14 hours, who knows, maybe she'll get even more bang out of the buck and he'll be working 20 hours, as I said, but at least maybe a little bit better.
You are optimistic, aren't you?
You have to be optimistic because you got to still work hard, as I said. And the bottom line is that stay on the medicine unless there's side effects. If there's side effects that are going to interfere and make things worse for them, then that's what they need to do. Then they have to stop it because it's a candy shop out there. There are so many medications out there for these patients to go for, but stay on it because as soon as you stop it, the bigger possibility is that you're going to go back, and then you have to kind of, then you're backtracking, and it's not good.
So I just want to give you the end of the case study. So what happened is I told the individual, look, you have to, this drug raises your serotonin levels, which makes you more positive, get you to work. So I want you to take it for 6 months and basically stop it at that time just to try and make sure the serotonin levels stay high. So at 6 months, he calls me up. He says, Dr. Fallon, I stopped it. And guess what? We're doing fantastic. And that's been 5 years ago. And the guy's still in business with his wife and things are good.
That's great.
So then going to the next question you mentioned about benzos. You mentioned Valium and Ativans. Mm-hmm. And we have all sorts of trouble, at least in the state of New Jersey, because the government now has people who are 80 years old, tell them to please pee in a cup. We need a drug sample on you and sign this 4-page agreement that you're not going to buy your benzos on the street or somewhere else. And it's very hard for me to ask somebody who's 85 years old to pee in a cup.
Mm-hmm.
But that's what's necessary now. So these benzos, you talked about using them short. How's your the anxiety? What's your posture on how long you treat with a benzo?
Well, with the benzos in the younger, in the millennials, it's very, very short periods of time. And a lot of the, with a certain case, I had to talk to a psychologist and psychiatrist, and they believe that you only did it for maybe a good, 2 to 3 weeks, and then you go ahead to calm them down enough that possibly they could go to the next point with a medication. So, as I said, so a little short period of time. Now, if they're a little bit older, as you know, you just got to be careful with the side effects. I mean, we don't want, Aunt Millie on something at 80 years old that's going to call an Ativan that's going to cause her to fall, break a hip. Then we got a whole new other issue going on. I don't worry about them with this whole dependency thing. Although, as I said, they've done their thing. I watch them carefully. But with the benzos and the young, we are very, very careful about. At that point, Joe, is just as long as it really improves their performance, and they're able then to get to the second part with an SSRI, with a therapist, with talking, with the CBI, the cognitive behavioral therapy, CBT, the cognitive behavioral therapy, then it all works out well. And another thing that is a very, very big topic is the role for medical marijuana with this anxiety.
Ouch.
And as I said, so, not pushing it, people. But all I'm saying to you is this, is that a lot of my elderly people that maybe don't want to be on the Ativans, or if they're on pain medications, God forbid, if they have, like back fractures, broken bones, anything like that, you don't want to start another dependence. But millennials said that, because you can go to some of the stores and get it, they use a little bit of the CBD oil just to go ahead and relax them. As I said, but again, we don't want that happening. So I have a lot of patients that may be a little bit older that have chronic pain, that have anxiety, whether it be separate or because of the chronic pain, that use that, and it does make a big difference. Because they, for some reason, there's such a stigma associated with these simple medications that make such a difference in their lives. And this, as I said, it's not really as much of a stigma, but they don't want to be on it long periods of time. They just don't want to be anxious.
So I just got to make one comment. So the CBD oil has no high to it. It's not a THC's got the high.
Right, correct.
But
right.
The CBD does not.
Right.
So you're
mm-hmm.
saying that the seniors who may have physical issues and that can help them out tremendously.
Yes, but and even some of the millennials as well, they've gone to, some of the therapists, and they have referred out to that as well also.
Okay, now listen, we have to give an 800 number here. Once we had CBD oil, it's time to call in the reserves. The toll-free number to call in is 888-728-9941, 888-728-9941. We have internist Dr. Delisa Domitio here, who is outgoing and a very good interviewer of her patients, and they love her. Cal, I think you have a question.
Well, first, a statement about how to reach our beloved doctor.
Okay.
Where is your office?
Well, my office is located at 1A Regulus right in Turnersville, New Jersey.
Say again.
1A Regulus on Turnersville, New Jersey.
Okay.
And the phone number is 856-256-7513, 856-256-7513. But I have to say, she doesn't have any problem with patients. I think they're overflowing.
Oh, well, I love all of them, and they know that.
I want to continue the questions. Why would you figure, and you've answered that question in part, that a large portion of your practice, especially now, because it wasn't that way, as Dr. Fallon pointed out, why now?
Well, I mean, you know, when you start getting a lot of the people from the pediatrician's office, because like they're 21 and up, you see a lot more. And then when I see a lot more, I start to learn about really these factors that are causing them to be so anxious, so nervous all the time. You know, Kel, it's a great question. There was an article about 9 tips for managing millennials and things that, you know, it's a different world today. We're very blessed to have them. They're very smart. The internet is out there. Their phones make them, I think, more nervous. I think social media. And I think that's what really sparked my interest in that when I saw an article about how social media really does get the millennials very anxious because they think, you know, Janie's doing so perfect and Molly has the perfect life. And, you know, Roberta is, you know, as I said, she's making millions and she's only working 3 hours a day. Okay. Well, those things don't work because that's one point in their time. So what we need to do is this, is that, when we have these people in practice and they come with these certain complaints, it's up to us to really say, okay, this is how we're going to approach it. And I think it's the whole approach. I want to give you an example, if you don't mind, not to talk the whole show, but I guess it's going to happen. As I said, there's three.
It's your show.
Oh, okay. Okay. That's great. Thank you. As I said, so basically there's 3 cases I want to bring up, 3 different cases. I have a lovely 23-year-old working in the office. She answers phones. And I interviewed some of my girls in multitude of other offices. She's doing so many tasks for the practice. And today, in an office, one person does 95 million things. It's not like one answers the phone, one files. Those days are over. But she never looks content. She doesn't look 100% happy. She knows that everybody has their cross in life. And she has a great supportive family, friends, great disposition, no depression. She just seems so anxious with her life.
You mean her cross for life is working for you?
No, I hope not. I hope not, as I said, because it's been a long time and I love her to pieces. The second case, you have a very intense worker. She's in nursing school. She works 2 other jobs. She always looks stressed out. She's increased her smoking, her drinking. I mean, I don't know how she has time to do any of that with working and going to school. She binge eats. She eats a lot. She doesn't eat enough. She's always at work on her phone stating that, look how great and easy everyone else's life is. And I have to work so hard. She lives at home with her parents. She's embarrassed about that. But she keeps herself very, very busy. She really doesn't have many responsibilities at home. She doesn't pay for any type of car insurance. But she's multitasking, but she has no good outcome, and she becomes so stressed out, and she's not productive at all. I mean, she has a good work ethic. I mean, she wants to work, but she doesn't really show up to work. She's not efficient. She's always on the phone. She's complaining. She's exhausted. And with all the work she has, she just does not find any meaning to her life.
And she's soon to be out of a job.
Right, exactly. I mean, as I said, exactly. Case number 3. Now, this is a physical example of stress, not only in the millennials, but everybody, and it basically can target conversation today. I mean, you have a 29-year-old who, again, isn't happy with her life, works part-time, supporting a child since she's a single parent, and every other job that she attempts to interview for, she's just not getting, and she feels overqualified. But she just can't see herself in a job working. She just can't see one job. She calls out a lot. She has constant headaches. She has this brain fog. She can't focus. She swears she's dying. She swears something's wrong with her. She said, I mean, at times her, it's called laziness and carelessness, but no parent, especially a single parent, is lazy or they're careless. Her weight fluctuations, she sleeps 1 to 2 hours because of stress, so she's not getting good quality sleep, complains of lots, that she has muscle aches and pains. So it causes a lot of absences of work, which causes even more stress and anxiety. She can't pay her bills. She has less money. She sees clumps of her hair coming out, so hair loss because she's so nervous. And she's very short-tempered with her child, which, again, even really gets a lot of stress in the household and causes, a lot of problems, within her, her family life. So these are all different ways when I see that when a patient comes in, when I hear these stories. And my job and every other physician's job, as I said, which Dr. Fallon does beautifully, is to really establish that relationship with them, make them feel comfortable that they can open up to you and tell you that story, and not to blow it off. Everybody's important, but you got to say, listen, let's break it down. Let's make sure you're not dying. Let's make sure of this, and let's get you in tune with the right people, the right medications, and let them know that you're listening, because I think once people hear that you're listening, then the world is right there. It's fabulous.
I want to point out that I believe her child, because of the mother, needs help a lot more than her mother.
Yeah, well, I think ultimately, but, moms are pretty amazing like that. And as I said, and I gave her a lot of credit because, I think the one thing that upset her the most was the fact of snapping at her child. There were no fun times together. And just, again, being a single parent, it was hard for her because she was mom, she was dad, she was that child's world. And you can't destroy a world like that to a child.
Good advice.
I'll hit you with this one. Again, define the root causes of this malady. And the medical term for root causes is etiology.
Well, again, the internet, again, social media, and that I provided with some of those examples. A lot of these people, the millennials that work, as I said, it provides, as I said, their jobs, the whole job description is different now. They want balances between personal and professional lives. This is in a wonderful Forbes magazine article. They listed the areas of the millennials in the workplace. Millennials don't believe that money is everything. They want this balance. But they can't take days off. They have to understand that you have to still work hard, which they do, but they want to make it like they want to create their own workplace. They want to collaborate instead of lead at times, but they have a great way of wanting to help the world. And I think that's where they don't see a future. They don't want to kill themselves working 95 hours, but they want to essentially they need that approval. They want to help things out on a bigger scale than I think I was really ever raised to do. They want a lot of recognition. They want recognition from their leaders and their peers. And they want the whole company's culture, as the Forbes says in this, and this is them saying this, which I agree 150%. They really want to be motivated to help their environment for bigger, better causes, but they really want to align their lifestyle with the culture of how they want to live. And it can't always be like that. So it's a square peg, round hole, but you got to melt that square peg into the round hole, and you got to make it work. Work hard, but lessen the anxiety. Know what you have to do, and just don't get anxiety. Accept it, but make it work for everybody.
Dr. DiMedio, fantastic. I love the one quote you said, everybody is important. And it seems to me you've got just a great ability to dig through the patient's history, do the physical, and then come up with a good advice for them. So kudos go your way. Now, I am sure somebody wants to give Dr. DiMedio a call. She is at 888-728-9941. If you want to talk to internist, and I'm going to just brand her psychiatrist, Dr. Lisa DiMedio. Cal, do you have a question?
Yes. What alternatives are available in treating anxiety?
Well, Cal, there were the medications. There was the cognitive behavioral therapy. There are a lot of books out there as well also. As I said, that would help that there's a lot of literature out there. There's also a National Alliance on Mental Illness, which essentially, believe it or not, back in basically in 1979, started around a kitchen table, which I thought was amazing, how it's a national alliance, and it's a very, very major voice on mental health, in which they really educate, advocate, listen, and they really lead about mental illnesses. It's basically one of the largest grassroots mental health organizations, but their goal is really to build better lives for millions of people that are affected by this. There are a lot of blogs. If people start writing blogs about this, they should. It's a journey. I think it's wonderful. I'm anxious. Take my anxiety at home, in the workplace, in my marriage. Let me start the unblind. Let's get through this road of anxiety. And then you're going to be surprised how many people say, you know what? I'm not alone. There's not a stigma here. This is great. There are other people out there like me. It's the acceptance and the route that, hey, I can write about it and listen about it and learn about it and get through this, maybe without medications, maybe without a therapist, maybe by just journaling. But there's nothing wrong with any approach. The whole idea is this, like I tell my patients, whatever works, I'm for it. I just want to see you happy and healthy and live a long life.
So, Dr. DiMedio, and there's a publication, 10 Secrets of Long Life, and one of them was exercise and nutrition. So these people are younger. Do you ever think that that's a good modus operandi for them to get defunct?
Absolutely. And a lot of them do that now also. I mean, they believe in the gym. They want to look good, as I said, which I think is fabulous. I give them a lot of a lot of credit for that. I think to be proud of the way you look will help build esteem. It's not everything about esteem, but, you know, you don't want to be overweight. You don't want to be short of breath. You want to feel good. And that's part of the feel good thing, the exercise and talking to a nutritionist if you don't know what to eat. I think it's so great because it makes you feel good. And let's face it, Joe, it's all about feeling good. It's all about less anxiety. If it's one anxiety, less thing about your self-esteem, which low self-esteem can cause a lot of this anxiety with the millennials, I think that this will help things out. And it really just gets you going, and it builds up your endorphins, and you feel great. And it's a great way to talk to people. You buddy up, you walk, you exercise, and you talk about things like that. And this is how relationships begin and problems are identified.
So really, you're an individual who cultivates optimism in their patients. You try and take a look at the good part and just get them to fix the low part, and then basically just to move ahead quickly because life's short, but
yes,
they're going to live longer and you're going to make sure they do it.
Exactly. And, you know, it's, I was brought up with so much love and surrounding me, and I still am. And everybody in my practice is my family. So when they come, and I try to say, okay, you know, and everybody has different people in their family. But it's very, sometimes at the beginning, it was hard for me to understand that because I was brought up with, you know, a lot of rules and regulations, and I respected and loved my patients, my parents for the way that I thank God for them every day. I was brought up with religion, which is beautiful, and I even encourage that with patients. I don't push it. If they don't believe in it, everybody believes in a God if you pray to them. But my thing is this, is that if it makes them feel better, that's what it's about. But it's my job to say, okay, don't go on the internet for the answer. Talk about it. And that's when you put your phone down and you say, hey, this is about me talking about it, and I'm going to get a lot further talking than texting. And this is where it all, you know, comes to fruition and everything. We're on the road to recovery.
So, Dr. DiMedio, we want to give you one chance to catch a breath. We have a caller. John, welcome to Inside Medicine, and Lisa DiMedio is in the house.
Good morning, John.
No, John.
Bye, John.
Okay, so John's gone. All right, so Lisa, what about high-risk behaviors? Is there anything that you point out to patients that, hey, look, this isn't the right thing to do?
You know, I try to tell them the worst thing to do is not talk about it. The best thing to do is to talk about it. But I don't want them going towards alcoholism. I don't want them to smoke. I don't want them to do anything that's going to just start another, dependency, but possibly is not going to fix the problem. The bottom line is this: you fix it at 22, you get better at 23 or 24, at least you know what you're dealing with. Because as we all know, Joe, life gets harder. And you know what? We can't let one thing put us down, because really in the big picture, and everybody, like I said, has their cross, it's really about being able to deal with it. And that's what we need to do. We need to allow people to give them the tools to really deal with it, and how to really say, listen, it's not about alcoholism. It's not about pills. It's about putting the whole picture together and seeing exactly not how to get a quick gratification on this, but soon enough that'll allow you to live a happy, normal life.
Fantastic. I think we have a caller. Irene, welcome to Inside Medicine with Dr. Lisa DiMedio, Cal Rudman, and Dr. Joe Fallon.
Yes. I have a question. And the question is, I was wondering if someone could comment on the correlation, if any, between mental health, depression, and hypothyroidism. Mm.
Well, I can certainly take that. So it's kind of very important to diagnose somebody with hypothyroidism because basically you get duller, you don't have that energy, you just can't believe what happened to you, and that everything goes slower. And on the other hand, there's the opposite with hyperthyroidism where people can spend a lot of money, buy cars, and do all sorts of things that they never did. And there is some wild behavior on the internet that someone who's hyperthyroid that they can, you know, give away their family's money. So both hypo and hyper are important. Now, the hypo is much more common. And in my practice, it's very important that there is a range of hypothyroidism. And if you take a look at normal, a TSH value, which stands for thyroid stimulating hormone, which indicates what your brain thinks of your thyroid function levels. And we have a high percentage of people who are hypothyroid. The number one sold drug in the United States is thyroid replacement. So you want to make sure that what is the right amount of TSH you should have. So should you be at the 97th percentile from the top, or you do want to be at the third percentile? So I do believe that one of the things that isn't done real well in medicine is that we titrate hypothyroid people to the right level that they want to be at. And that's why sometimes it's always nice to have a baseline thyroid level. So, again, I think that's very important what you just brought up because mental health is very, very tied to how much thyroid activity you have. Very, very important. It's got to do with fertility. It's got to do with perk and pop. It's got to do with how well you're going to do. It has to do with how well your medicine is going to respond. So if you went to somebody like Dr. DiMedio, she wouldn't miss hypothyroid. She'd perk them up, and then that way her medicine can work and you'll get better quicker. So, okay. Irene, thank you. Any other part of the question that you want to ask?
No, that's it.
All right. We appreciate you calling Inside Medicine. Dr. DiMedio, do you want to comment on thyroid disease in your practice?
You know, we see so much of it, and I think with all that's out there on the internet for people to look at when they sometimes research it to see why they're depressed, why they're anxious, there is a lot out there. And when they do come in, like I said before, it is the medical issues that we address first. And sometimes we see people that do feel so much better when they do take the thyroid hormone, when they do take that, and if there is an actual thyroid issue, and they feel better. They're not as sad. They're not as depressed, as I said, and they're not as anxious either about other things. It's a very interesting medication as far as they don't have the brain fog that possibly we see with the anxious person if they're not sleeping or eating right or things like that, but it also could be a thyroid, underlying thyroid disorder as well.
Yeah, and other items just to pick up metabolically are B12 deficiency. We have 12% of the population B12 deficient. It's very important if you're going to be diagnosed, you can't take your multivitamin with tons of B12 in it within 72 hours of having your blood drawn because it basically hides the real diagnosis. So if 12% of the people are bummed out and it's because of B12 deficiency, you just want to make that diagnosis easy to fix. Those people who don't eat red meat, that's where most of us get our B12, are prone to that. So B12, definitely get it. A lot of people come out with folate deficiency. There are certain metabolic things that just play into a disease such as depression, anxiety, and it's just worthwhile making that diagnosis.
And I would have a few other things to say that I want people to understand, and I'm not attacking the millennials, as I said, and parents of millennials. You've done a great job. The kids are great, but my case, even though I'm not a psychiatrist or psychologist, the idea, again, we must help everybody. So mental illness is very difficult, and today's millennials are more open about it, more aware about it, and continue to write about it, continue to read blogs about it, tell people how you truly feel. Yeah, you are stressed. I mean, they feel as though that this fast-paced internet and social media, this quick gratification, it makes it even worse. But remember, there are ways to fix this. So you want to just take it, and you want to accept it, and you want to do something about it before you get older, and it paralyzes you from doing everything. Because, you know, you're all much smarter than I ever was. You have a lot to do in this world, and you really can make a very, very big difference in this world. And there's two misnomers. Don't ever be embarrassed. If all your friends say they're not anxious and you are, they're lying. Don't go by Facebook. Even though somebody looks fabulous and happy, they have their sadness too, so don't judge by that. You can't compare personal and professional achievement on one picture. That's one point in their life. You want them to be happy, but don't, because this will dig very low with your self-esteem. And remember, the social media can complicate life. Turn it off. Don't compare yourself to the world, because you know what? You have a lot to offer, and the good news is, remember, back in the day, they didn't talk about it. Now we can talk about it. Open up to everybody that you possibly can, whether it be your parents, your friends, your spouses, your priest, anybody. Start with the primary care doctor. We're here to listen for you, because it's fixable, and you know what, millennials? We do need you in this world. As I said, and there is a great, great quote by a woman by the name of Molly Buford, and she's a writer, editor, and digital strategist in Denver, Colorado. And it was a fabulous quote, I thought, because she writes in a lot of the younger magazines, but she really sums up the treatment of the millennials so beautifully in a nutshell. She said, "You have plenty of people in your life who love you deeply and for good reason. Don't ever lose sight of this fact. Your anxiety does not make you unlovable, not even close."
Fantastic, fantastic. Cal.
You mentioned this, the medications that are used, also about literature on this topic. I'm sure the libraries have a lot of material. It's pretty well spread around, the amount of material.
Yes, it is. I mean, if you Google anxiety in millennials, or, you know, millennials and, you know, as I said, in present, any type of psychological states, I mean, there's so much out there, Kel. It's unbelievable. And the medications are great, and a lot of them start it, and it's good, because as soon as they start it, it makes a huge difference when they're in college, even younger, and it just allows them to say, hey, we can do this, and that's the most important thing.
I wanted to continue in the reality of the human animals, quote-unquote. There are so many people, more than ever, who are single, went through life. Marriage never came their way, be it male, female. And I'm sure you see many of those single people.
Yes.
And the older they get, and you mentioned loneliness, have no family, or all their relatives have already passed away, as time goes by, you're alone. Now what happens when they come to see you?
Well, it's a wonderful question, and I see that. I do see that a lot, and my heart goes out to them. And it's pretty amazing the amount of people that are out there that extend themselves to people that, even though they're not family, they help them. They take them grocery shopping. There's so many groups now that will help them. A lot of these people, we try to we don't try to fix them up. It's not like I'm a yenta, but what I do is that I try to get them in with groups that they can maybe go to breakfast with, and you know, so they're not by themselves. It's very, very interesting. Or maybe if they don't want to live alone, they want to maybe go to an over 55 community where it is a community, it is a family. Because ultimately, listen, we will all be alone. Whether we have children, we don't have spouses. It's at the end, it's about us. So as I said, and a lot of them really turn to things that they really wouldn't have turned to before. They actually open up more. If they need some type of a medication to maybe get them out there, because they've always had to deal with things themselves, or be alone, and maybe they, you know, you get very fixed in your ways like we all do, then they do it, and then they extend themselves out. And it's just great because now they volunteer at hospitals. They want to work. They go to libraries and they volunteer. They go to certain stores and they love it. And it's just neat. A lot of them go to schools and, and a lot of the vets, they go and they tell their stories. I just think it's so beautiful because the older they get, the more wisdom that they have. That's something you don't get on social media. You don't get on the internet. It's all about what you talk about, and that builds an even stronger relationship, but I think it is wonderful. But it does break my heart when I do see that. But they fix it. It's fixable.
So, Lisa, we have a second caller, do we? Hello? Oh, not yet. So, anyway, Lisa, that loneliness is really a fantastic statement that you made. I tell the story all the time to say how bad loneliness is. I was covering a doctor who had a nursing home practice, and the rule was that if you pass away, you have to come within 12 hours and pronounce the patient. So I walked in the room, and the first door had a lady in there. She must have been about 75, 80. And she says, doctor, please talk to me for 30 minutes. I'm so lonely. And I'm like looking at her, and across in the other bed is someone who passed away, and she wants to talk for 25 minutes. You know, just like it was a bizarre feeling how bad that loneliness was. You know, it's just somebody's dead next to you, and can you talk to me for 25 minutes? That was one tough deal.
Yeah. I mean, it breaks your heart, as I said, because we were always brought up that nobody, you never want anybody to be alone, as I said, and you can't be there for everybody, obviously, but the patient that just wants to, and some of the patients just want to come in and talk, and I welcome that. I mean, as I said, it's difficult at times, but they just want to come in, and you see how their whole response, their whole facial expressions, their whole, like, they drag coming in, they just want to talk about things, like, doc, what do you think of this, what do you think of that? And the people that you think have the most people around them are the loneliest people. And I think that's even harder than being by themselves and not having anybody, because they really don't. But you see some lives change when they go out bowling twice a week, or they go and they – or they're with young people, or they volunteer. It's just beautiful. But I used to see a lot of that in the hospital and the nursing home as well. And they said, so-and-so just dropped us off here and nobody would go to see them. It's very, very difficult with that.
Yep, or find the local senior citizens hanging out at McDonald's for coffee.
Yeah, every day, exactly.
But Dr. Mitty, we have a doctor calling in. Welcome to Inside Medicine.
Yeah, it's Dr. Petruncio. I have a question for Dr. Demedia.
Oh, hi.
Dr. George.
And how are you?
Fine. Listening to the whole program. Very good program.
Oh, thank you.
The question I have is if you ever do hypnosis or for retrograde for diagnosis for anxiety.
You know, George, I do not do any type of hypnosis for that. As I said, it's great, and thank you, because I had other things like acupuncture, with the yoga, things like that, but never the hypnosis. Have you had a good experience with that?
Yes, I have. It's in the hands of a good hypnotist and a good psychiatrist. Sometimes you can reveal what the origins are of the anxiety.
That's fabulous. And do they have to go for multiple, you should be sitting next to me. Do they have to go for multiple treatments? Is it one and done?
Well, I think the main thing is that it goes as the identifier of the anxiety.
Mm-hmm. That's wonderful.
And that's one of the things that really is underutilized.
Yes. I'm sure you see this as well also in your practice.
Yeah. The second thing is that with the millennials, that there seems to be a disconnect with social functioning with texting. Now, I've observed this with women, that they usually have a tendency to have a protection of a distance from texting. Do you agree with this?
Yes. Mm-hmm. Absolutely. Absolutely.
And that it makes the inability to interact with people, and that increases their anxiety.
Yes, and that's what we have to try to, as much as we can to our millennials when they come in, that it's not all, in that rectangular box. It's not all the answers. It's not really how you communicate with people, and it won't help you. You know, and you know, Georgia, and I'm sure you see this as well also, it doesn't make them. That's not really what treats them and makes them better. You know, actually, it makes it worse. I think that this is why we're seeing so many patients coming in the way they are.
Yeah. Do you think that the millennials today have life just too easy?
You know, I think the information is at their fingertips. I think that obviously if we look at our parents and grandparents, their lives were so much harder. They had so much less. They worked harder. They had nothing. But you know what? They were happier. So I think some things are handed to them, but I think that, and not to pick on them, I think things are given to them because it's either their way or no way. There's not too much, you know, you can't really talk about it too much. So even at the workplace, it's not about me telling them what to do. No, 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 no. It's, this is the way I want it. I want a good lifestyle. I mean, it's not even about the money half the time. It's about a good lifestyle. It's about having relaxation. It's about this. It's about having lunch. It's about having like a appropriate amount of vacation time. We, in what we do for a living, and you understand, we didn't have that. That's not the way it was. So I think handing everything to them, I don't think they're handed in a bad way. I think parents, you know, I wasn't blessed to be a parent, but, you know, as I said, the parents try to make their kids' lives so wonderful. And it's just misinterpreted at times, I think, the way that outcomes of what happens.
So George,
in other words, when I was growing up, we had the draft. You were going to go off in the service.
That's right.
A lot of younger men went in and went through military service and learned basic life skills. You don't have that anymore.
No, I know.
So we're just going to get – we're coming close to the end. Dr. Petrunzio, I thank you. Dr. Domitio, I thank you.
Thank you.
Make sure that there is a podcast here, www.610espn.com. You can listen to Lisa's show. We want to point out that Dr. Eric Fleischman will be in next week talking about menopause, hormones, et cetera, and he is a practicing physician with lots of experience, Ebola, et cetera, and his practices in Thailand. So we want to see everybody next week at 10 o'clock. We thank everybody for joining Lisa and myself and Cal tonight. Thank you.
Thank you.